This is a perfect storm of conspiracy theories.
On December 15th, 2017, Canadian billionaires Honey and Barry Sherman were found dead in their mansion. To this day, the case remains unsolved.
Counterfeit and copied pharmaceuticals was much more lucrative than heroin, cocaine, and the rest of it.
If you live by the sword, you die by the sword.
Listen to the no good, terribly kind, wonderful lives and tragic deaths of Barry and Honey Sherman, wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
Hello, I'm Matt Galloway, and this is The Current Podcast. My next guest is Scott Galloway. Even though we both have the same last name and both host audio programs, we are not related. Then again, if we had more in common, I might be a lot richer. Scott made a small fortune building companies, and then a bigger one, investing in companies like Apple and Amazon. It might be enough of a career for some people, but he is also a professor at NYU. He hosts two popular podcasts, Pivot and the Prof G Pod. He also is an author and has a new book about to come out. And if you're in Vancouver, you can catch him speaking at this year's TED conference next week. Scott Galloway, hello.
How are you, Matt?
There aren't many corporate leaders and business analysts who talk as much as you do about inequality. When did you start worrying about the gap between the rich and the poor?
Well, if you just look at the data, you know, 1% of the population is capturing 90% of the gains. For the first time in our nation's history, a 30-year-old isn't doing as well as his or her parents were at the age of 30. And we have such extraordinary prosperity in the U.S., but similar to what William Gibson said about the future, it's here, it's just not evenly distributed. So income inequality just gets worse and worse, and what I find especially frustrating is we know how to solve it, it's just the incumbents who are benefiting from it want to plead complexity and have weaponized government to ensure that it continues.
What's at the root of increasing inequality, do you think?
A lack of respect and recognition for what is the greatest innovation in the West, and it's not the iPhone or the semiconductor, it's the middle class. And the incumbents would like you to believe that the middle class is an accident and a self-healing organism. It's not. It requires massive investment. The kind of straight market dynamic is that eventually powerful people weaponize government, weaponize the tax code, subsidies, corruption, and more money gets crowded into the top 1%. And at some point, the bottom 99 solve that either through war, famine, or revolution. So I think that it's the natural order of things. And unless you make massive investments in the middle class, whether it's through infrastructure acts or lower taxes or state-sponsored education that gives unremarkable people such as myself an opportunity to have remarkable lives. When I applied to UCLA, the acceptance rate was 76%. This year, it'll be 9%. When you have a tax rate on wealthy people is somewhere in the high teens, and on corporations, it's never been lower. You've effectively given up on what is the key to our prosperity, and that is the middle class. The middle class funded GPS, DARPA. Show me a billionaire. I'm going to show you someone who's built a thick layer of innovation on top of a public infrastructure investment, whether it's Amazon and the United States Postal Service or Apple in GPS or Google and DARPA, and yet aren't paying their fair share. So I've become a bit of a populist around this. And just the last point, Daniel Kahneman, who recently died, the behavioral economist, showed that at a certain point, incremental income doesn't add any more happiness. So at some point, I feel like we should restore a more progressive tax structure.
What did you say? The middle class is the greatest invention? I mean, more so than this fancy phone that's sitting in front of me.
Well, that fancy phone is really built on top of investments that were made by the greatest venture capitalists in history, and that is the U.S. government, and the greatest investors, and that's the middle class. Essentially, the middle class kind of formed in the U.S. post-World War II, and we brought home 7 million men from war. They had demonstrated excellence in uniform, and we had the National Highway Act that took $500 billion, gave them jobs, gave them GI Bill, student loans, or subsidized housing, loans for housing, and quite frankly, made them quite attractive to women, huge household formation, huge birth rates, the baby boom, and gave them the confidence and kind of progressive liberal ideals that resulted in civil rights, women's rights, and all of this created more innovation, more taxes, more infrastructure and public investment. And in the last 20 or 30 years, I think there's been a move towards lowering that investment such that the incumbents can garner more and more gains. COVID was a perfect example. $6 trillion stimulus, 85% of it wasn't spent. It went into the market. What did that do? It exploded housing values. You in Canada are ground zero for these exploding housing values. Education prices up, so young people can't afford a house. They can't afford the certification to get ahead. And they have the prosperity of other people shoved in their faces every day through algorithms that want to convince them that if they haven't made $1 million trading Dogecoin or working at NVIDIA that somehow they failed, and it's producing the most anxious, depressed young generation in our nation's history.
You often compare, and you've just done this in talking about, you know, describing yourself as unremarkable. You compare what life was like for young people in your generation to what's happening now. You grew up with a single mom, not a lot of money. What's changed, do you think?
America, and to a lesser extent, but a similar extent, Canada, have embraced a rejectionist, exclusionary positioning where we let in fewer kids into elite colleges, and the alumni love it. Everyone brags that I couldn't get into my school now if I applied, which means your daughter isn't getting in. Housing permits do not keep up with population growth because the best way to increase the value of your house is to ensure that no new housing gets built. Big companies have become monopolies and make it more and more difficult for small companies to emerge. So we have this sort of exclusionary rejectionist culture that makes people with current assets, current degrees, makes the value of their assets explode, but it makes it harder for new entrants, specifically the young. And unfortunately, the optimism we have in Canada and the U.S. is sort of goes from a feature to a defect because we all think that our kid is in the top 1%. I can prove to each of us mathematically that 99% of our children are not in the top 1%. And I believe the role of government and really the basis of America and democracies is to give the bottom 90 a chance to be in the top 10. And I often say that I'm not a humble person. I think I'm remarkably talented. But the reason I'm here with you right now is big government, the generosity and vision of California taxpayers and the Regency of the University of California that gave me an amazing education and accessible education. Everybody got in when they applied. And then coming of age in a period where I could buy a house. You realize our grandparents on an inflation-adjusted level at 25 were making $105,000. I was making 70 or 80. Kids now at 25 are making $50,000. And this is in the face of unbelievable prosperity. So we have decided to transfer wealth from the young to the old, full stop.
You call yourself a populist?
I call myself a capitalist. And I just think the only way you can build a base of infrastructure and innovation and kind of the large-scale investments you need in vaccine research and technology and space travel and defense and a navy and social programs for people who need it such that we don't have homeless people everywhere, which affects all of us, is to have a progressive tax system.
And so for people who say that the system is stacked against them, you don't say that capitalism is part of that system? You think that it can be used for good, not for what we're seeing right now?
I don't think what we have now is capitalism. I think it's cronyism. Mm. I think capitalism recognizes that you need a strong base of public investment to invest in longer-term infrastructure projects that don't have a short-term payoff. Unless you create a base of the middle class that produces economically prosperous, loving households that generate jobs, income, and taxes, and a sense of fair play and a sense of optimism, you're going to have a society that just slowly but surely becomes very Darwinian and becomes like the Hunger Games. It's never been easier to be a billionaire in the United States. It's never been harder to be a millionaire. And I think it makes us less happy. I think the incremental gains you get from going from 10 to 100 million are almost negligible. But the gains from going from 40 to 60,000 with a college degree or a chance to buy a house or a chance to be economically viable so that you can find a mate, I think those are extraordinary gains in happiness. And unfortunately, I think in the U.S., our elected leaders, which are a cross between the Golden Girls and The Walking Dead, they've gotten so goddamn old, can't relate to the problems and challenges of devices, technology, or just how hard it is for young people to buy a house or get that kind of certification to be successful in today's information economy.
You talk a lot and you write a lot about young men in particular and the declining fortunes of young men. Why is that such a big concern for you?
Well, I relate to it. There's no group in America that's fallen further faster than young men. It's now 2-to-1 female to male college grads. More single women own homes in the U.S. Than single men. 50% of high school kids are seeing their friends every day, 50% less. The most anxious, depressed generation in history. And it especially impacts young men because, one, young men don't have as strong of friend networks. So when they're isolated, they tend to become just terrible citizens. They're more prone to nationalistic content, more prone to misogynistic content, believe in conspiracy theory, less likely to believe in climate change. And we have a series. We have the most valuable, genius, well-resourced companies in the world, all producing algorithms that want to convince young people that there's a reasonable facsimile of life they can have that's low risk, low entry, low cost at home. That, oh, why work when you can trade Dogecoin or stocks on Coinbase or Robinhood? You don't need real life friends. You can go on Discord or Reddit. You don't need to find a girlfriend and take the risks and endure the rejection and develop the skills to find a mate. You can go on YouPorn or Tinder, and all of this is a disaster, especially for young men who, when they don't have the prospect of a romantic relationship, have very little social kind of nets to catch them. Women are much better at maintaining social connection.
I was just going to say, I could imagine there are a lot of people listening who would say, who would push back on that idea that young men are the ones who are falling in particular, because women earn, what, 78 cents to a man's dollar. There's a stat in Canada that there's more CEOs named Michael than there are women CEOs. And you could imagine people saying, why are we worrying about young men in particular?
So there's some nuance there. First, at the CEO level, there's absolutely a problem. And what you find is that once women have children, that's when their pay goes to, I think it's 73 cents on the dollar. So corporate America and corporate Canada have still not figured out a way to maintain a woman's trajectory once she gets to a senior level. That's an issue. It warrants scrutiny. There's about 83 female CEOs in the Fortune 500. So what is that, about 17%? That's clearly a problem. But at a younger age, women in the U.S. living in urban areas are actually making more money than their male counterparts under the age of 30 because they're attaining better certification because they're going to college in greater numbers. And if you look at levels of depression and suicide, the numbers are just striking. Men are 4 times more likely to kill themselves than women, 3 times more likely to be addicted, 12 times more likely to be incarcerated. So an honest appraisal of looking at men or young men versus young women, there's just no getting around it. Young women are ascending, and it's wonderful, and we should do nothing to stop that progress. It's a real sign of victory. But young men are failing. The 1 in 3 men under the age of 30 has a girlfriend. 2 in 3 women have a boyfriend. And it's because they're dating older, because they can't find economically or viable young men. And you think, well, loneliness is a problem for both of them. But essentially what you have, if we're going to have an honest conversation about household formation, we need to have an honest conversation. Women mate socioeconomically horizontally and up, men horizontally and down. And the pool of horizontal and up among young men is decreasing. And unfortunately, men respond much more negatively to loneliness than women. When we hear about somebody leaking secrets on Discord, military secrets, or a mass shooting, we know who it is before we know who it is. We know it's a young, lonely male who's trying to recapture social status, who didn't have an adult male role model and feels shunned by women. So it's a problem, but I would argue that there's just no doubt about it. Women are ascending. Young men especially are descending.
Hello, I'm Jess Milton. For 15 years, I produced The Vinyl Cafe with the late, great Stuart McLean. Every week, more than 2 million people tuned in to hear funny, fictional, feel-good stories about Dave and his family. We're excited to welcome you back to the warm and welcoming world of The Vinyl Cafe with our new podcast, Backstage at The Vinyl Cafe. Each week, we'll share 2 hilarious stories by Stuart, and for the first time ever, I'll tell you what it was like behind the scenes. Subscribe for free wherever you get your podcasts.
What's the kind of masculinity that you try to model? This is something that you talk about in the podcast. I mean, it almost, I don't know whether you agree with this term, but there is a self-help nature to how you frame some of this. What's the kind of masculinity that you try to model?
So the first is to acknowledge or stop this conversation or this myth that masculinity is toxic. It's not. No one speaks about toxic femininity, and we should stop saying that masculinity is toxic.
Is part of it toxic, or?
It can be. I think DEI can be toxic. I think everything, if taken to a weird extreme, I think real masculinity, in my opinion, is garnering the strengths and skills such that you can protect others. You want to protect yourself. You want to have a plan. You want to be physically fit. You want to be action-oriented. Then you want to take care of your family. Then you want to take care of your community. And then real masculinity, the ultimate expression of masculinity, in my view, is to get involved in the life of a child that isn't yours biologically. And the men we remember are the men who plant the seeds of which the trees of the shade of which we will never sit under. So when I think about masculinity, I think about service. I also think it's about protecting people. And I think it's also about acknowledging that your responsibilities as a man are to embrace the fantastic progress that women have made, and also to have an honest conversation. If you want to take economic responsibility for your household, recognize that sometimes your partner is better at this whole money thing, and be more supportive of her career and get out of the way. Maybe you don't understand the trans community, but your first instinct as a man should be to protect them, not to demonize them. And I find that what we see across the manosphere is that it's this thinly veiled misogyny. They start talking about owning women. They start talking about buying supercars.
Who's they?
The Andrew Tates of the world. I think there's been a lot of commentators, a lot of negative voices have filled this void. What you had was essentially on the far right, they see masculinity as aggressive, more of a sort of a dominant sort of viewpoint to embrace masculinity. And on the far left, it's no better. Basically, the vision of masculinity on the far left is to act more like a woman. I don't think that's correct either.
Really?
I think we need a more... I think that's what they're basically saying. I think schools are basically telling young boys to act like young girls.
What do you mean?
What's the model student? Sit still, be organized, have color-coded, raise your hand, be a pleaser. I think that they're basically describing the attributes that more easily come to a young girl. I think educational institutions are highly biased against men on a behavior-adjusted basis. And to your point, I still think the corporate world has some bias, especially at senior levels, against women. But I think we have to have an honest conversation and restore masculinity as a fantastic attribute, but redefine it as service and protecting and advocating for others.
What are you most worried about when it comes to, I mean, you mentioned Andrew Tate, about the influence of people like that, that characterize masculinity in a very different way than you are?
I mean, keep in mind, all of these guys are essentially at the end of their big ride. It starts out fine. Take responsibility. Be physically fit. Be action-oriented. And then it goes to a weird place around women are assets or property to be controlled. And oh, by the way, take my course on how to trade crypto so you too can be a baller. And I don't think this is a healthy vision for masculinity. I think it diminishes women and not seeing them as an incredibly important part of our society and equals. And I also think it's self-destructive. And I think we're creating a generation of young men who are angry and isolated and, quite frankly, just not very good citizens. But at the same time, I think there's certain attributes that are more easily embraced by people born as men. And we're having a great conversation around the continuum, and then people who are non-binary deserve the same rights and respect that everyone else does. And I think gender is a wonderful thing. We need to continue to celebrate the wonderful attributes more likely to be found in people born as women, but also restore some respect and admiration for some of the attributes assigned to people born as men. It's wonderful to be strong. When soldiers come pouring across the border in Ukraine, you need some of that big dick energy. We want men who are prone to action. We want men to feel a sense of service and protection for their country and their families. I think these are wonderful attributes.
How do you square that with your, I was going to say obsession, maybe that's the right word, with penis jokes?
Well, okay, so some of that is what you're talking about for your listeners is I make a profane joke at the beginning of every podcast. Now, there is a strategy to it. First, let me just acknowledge I'm a profane person, and I think the majority of us have these thoughts, and we just don't like to say them out loud. The second is I consider myself a progressive, and I want the left to take back vulgarity and profanity. And what I think is dangerous, I think part of the left's problem is we're seen as humorless. So for me, I want to take back vulgarity and profanity for the left, and I also want to acknowledge that being able to rib each other and speak profanely is part of what it means to be affectionate and understand and recognize and kind of rib each other's differences. But I want the left to take back profanity and vulgarity, and I want to lead that charge.
It's fun listening to you and your co-host on Pivot, Kara Swisher, go back and forth on this. I can't tell whether she appreciates the jokes or whether she's disgusted or it's a mixture of both.
Yes. The answer is yes.
The answer is yes.
But the truth is, I say something vulgar and she pauses, or I make fun of her sexuality, Kara's a lesbian. She pauses and then she laughs and she gives everyone else permission to laugh. Mm. I think part of appreciating each other's differences is using humor, not to diminish each other, but to acknowledge and accept each other's differences. So I'd like to think we're helping.
You've mentioned the algorithm a couple of times. You've said that Mark Zuckerberg is the most dangerous person on the planet. And you've talked about how the way that social media has its talons in us only changes if one of the people who runs one of these companies is marched off very publicly to prison. Why do you think that?
We thought in the world of marketing that it was sex that sells, and it does, but we found something else sells better, and that is rage. And that is, if you go online and say something that's incendiary and upsets people, you get more and more comments. So one of the worst things that happened to our society was that the internet was built on the ad model, and enragement equals engagement equals Nissan ads equals more money. And so these algorithms, which are neither malicious nor benign, just see that controversy and misinformation creates more shareholder value. Almost unwittingly, these what I call amoral management have built companies that essentially pit us against each other and make us feel bad about ourselves, shove what I call like wealth porn in people's face, or just get them arguing with each other. The way people behave online and then the way that content gets algorithmically elevated by these companies trying to sell more ads, and quite frankly, by adversaries who have a vested interest in diminishing our power, so they see the easiest way to diminish that power is to divide us. I think it's just been a disaster for us.
And you think someone like Zuckerberg should go to prison for that?
I think if you know that you are depressing teens, and there's evidence showing that your algorithms are depressing teens, and you do nothing, not only do nothing to fix it, but you cover it up, and you use very charming people to go in front of Congress And then your company sends emails to a 14-year-old girl in the UK who is having suicidal ideation, and the algorithm picks that up and so begins sending her emails that say, quote, here are some images on suicide we thought you might find interesting. And this exact thing happened. And then the parents walk in the next day into that kid's room and find that 14-year-old girl is gone. Someone needs to go to jail.
Should it be him?
I'm not a lawyer. I don't want to start pretending I'm a judge and jury. But until there's a perp walk, the fines aren't big enough to discourage them. The algebra of deterrence is simple. That is, the probability of getting caught times the punishment has to be greater than the upside. And when these companies create trillions of dollars in upside, the penalty can't be big enough financially. So in my opinion, none of this stops until someone does a perp walk.
If you go back to that issue of inequality that we started with, do you think these big companies should be broken apart, like Apple or Google, Microsoft, Meta, as it's now called?
Oh, 100%.
Would that be better for the users that we're talking about?
Oh, yeah. You'd have part of the reason these companies are not innovating as fast as they used to is they have no competition. Meta owns 2/3 of social media. Alphabet owns 93% of search. So what is their motivation to put in place these types of controls? If P&G does not want to advertise on Meta or Google, but they have no choice. If there was a platform that wasn't depressing teens or radicalizing young men, they would advertise on that platform. But if they want to be seen online where young people are, they have to advertise on these platforms. Amazon is now taking upwards of 40 or 50% of fees of third-party retailers on the platform. They used to take 19. Why? If you want to sell your products online, you have to go through Amazon. We have a series of toll booths called Amazon, Alphabet, and Meta that basically 40 cents on the venture capital dollar ends up in one of those three places. The greatest tax cut on consumers and parents would be if we had more of these companies bidding on our time and our ad dollars. This is absolutely, if these companies got broken up, the employees would make more money because there'd be more people bidding on their time. The shareholders would benefit. When AT&T was broken up, all seven of the companies were worth more than the original within 10 years. The government would win because it had more tax revenue. It's the current people in charge of the company who want to sit on the Iron Throne of all seven realms, not just Westeros. They want to reign over bigger kingdoms. There are very few times we've ever looked back and thought that breaking up the company was bad for society, taxpayers, and the consumer. We would win huge. The best way to oxygenate the economy right now in the West would be to break up these companies.
Just before I let you go, let me ask about individual responsibility. What is the responsibility of wealthy people like yourself to change the economy, to make it more fair?
To elect leaders that understand technology and aren't going to try and feather their nest when they leave by ignoring these very difficult issues. So just as a citizen, to start sending people who will stand up to these companies and have thoughtful legislation. As an individual, I think it's to take the temperature down. And I've tried to do this. I don't get into fights on Twitter with people anymore. I realize I don't have to respond to every slight and just try and reflect some of the kindness I'd like to think I demonstrate at home and with my neighbors and with people I meet online.
What about paying taxes? I mean, how much more should the wealthy pay in taxes, do you think?
A lot more.
What does that mean from your perspective? I mean, how much more would you be willing to give up?
Oh, let me be clear. I'm not going to disarm unilaterally. I do everything I can to avoid taxes. I give away a lot of money, but I try to keep my tax rate as low as I can legally. But I think people should try and pay as little taxes as they can legally. But the reality is the rich have absolutely weaponized the tax code and are now paying less taxes than people who make less money. The people who get really screwed by our tax code are what I call the workhorses. That's people who make, say, between $150,000 or $200,000 and $1 million. And they make it in current income. So all their income is reportable. They make enough money to be in the highest tax brackets. But they don't make enough money to make the jump to Lightspeed. What is that? To transition their money into investments and capital that qualifies for long-term capital.
To stash it away.
It is much more tax advantage. I pay 22.8%. My average tax rate the last 10 years has been 17%. That makes no sense. I mean, literally, that makes no sense. 17%.
What do you think is at stake? Just finally, if the middle class continues to be hollowed out, if that, what you started talking about the gap between the rich and the poor and that growing inequality, if that's not, if the brakes aren't put on that, what's at stake, do you think?
Well, the good news is that once income inequality gets to a certain point, it always self-corrects. That's the good news. The bad news is the means of self-correction are either war, famine, or revolution. I just think we're getting to the point where we're having more nationalism. We elect people who are near fascist who claim that they understand you. When you're not doing well and you're so frustrated, you don't even go after ideology. You just go after chaos and change. I think Donald Trump is purely a manifestation of income inequality. People are willing to ignore him. They ignore the issues. They just want change. And anyone who's the biggest agent of change is someone who brings chaos and has no respect for the current institutions. And that defines Donald Trump. And I think we're seeing more and more of that around the world. And then taking it down to a ground level, do you have kids, Matt?
I do, two.
Okay, so you know this. You have your world of work, you have your world of friends, and you have your kids. When something comes off the tracks with one of your kids, nothing else matters. Mm-hmm. We have the most anxious, depressed generation in history. They see prosperity everywhere. It's shoved in their face. They feel bad about themselves. And we have technology companies that have run amok unfettered. Everything we talk about is the means. The ends is having loving households that are secure. And the only way we have that is if we raise a generation of young people who have the prosperity and the mental health to find other relationships, have children, and enjoy some of the fruits we've enjoyed. And we are sequestering that from them. And that means the whole shooting match is up for grabs here. If our kids aren't happy, we are not going to be happy.
Scott Galloway, it's a great pleasure to talk to you. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Matt. Thanks for your good work.
Scott Galloway hosts the podcast Prof G. He's the co-host of Pivot with Kara Swisher. His book, The Algebra of Wealth, comes out later on this month, and he will be speaking in Vancouver next week as part of the TED 2024 conference.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.